1972, the FDA began an over-the-counter drug review to study the safety and effectiveness of ingredients used in over-the-counter drugs. So far, they found that only about one-third of the ingredients reviewed are safe and effective. The FDA decided it would not act on its findings until all the research was completed. This project, which was expected to last 5 years, is still in progress, and consequently, ingredients they found to be unsafe or ineffective are still being marketed and advertised in non-prescription drugs. With me is Dr. Cindy Wolf, who, with members of the Health Research Group, has written a new book titled Over-the-Counter Pills That Don't Work, A Guide to Over-the-Counter Drugs, which rates drugs and individual ingredients according to safety and effectiveness. The Health Research Group compares its own ratings to those of the FDA. This book is a companion to the Health Research Group's Guide to Prescription Pills That Don't Work. Dr. Cindy Wolf co-founded the Public Citizen Health Research Group in 1971 with Ralph Nader. It's a consumer organization working for protection against unsafe foods, drugs, and workplaces. Wolf is also the co-author of Taking the Pain Out of Finding a Good Dentist, and also co-authored a study on Valium and other tranquilizers. His new book, Over-the-Counter Pills That Don't Work, is published by Pantheon. And a little later in the program, we'll be opening up the telephones for your questions and comments. I want to welcome you to Fresh Air. Let's discuss some of the general guidelines before we discuss some specific over-the-counter remedies. Your general guidelines to deciding if an over-the-counter remedy is worth taking. First of all, you always recommend generics over brand names when possible. How come?
Well, even a step back, in a number of cases, the self-treatment for a problem may not even involve drugs at all. What we try and do is lead people from the symptoms they have, which one can look up in a index of symptoms, to what kind of problems the symptoms represent, a cold, whatever. And in a number of instances, such as constipation, such as some of the symptoms of a cold, such as difficulty falling asleep, we really recommend not to use any drugs at all, changes in diet, changes in some lifestyle. However, for a number of other kinds of problems, we do recommend products which are safe and effective. And I think the basic principle is to take a single ingredient product, often if not always available generically, to treat the symptom that's bothering you rather than a 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 ingredient product that may have what you need for the symptom you have, but it also may have a second ingredient which isn't safe or effective, and it might have a third or fourth ingredient for some things that you don't have. The best example of that kind of thing are these multiple ingredient cold preparations where they have a drug for every symptom anyone ever had for a cold, even though you might just have one or two symptoms. So we're really trying to educate people to dissect out what is bothering them the most and learn the names, the generic names of the products, so they can go in and ask for them by generic name to save a lot of money, because we estimate that people are wasting at least $3 or $4 billion of the $10 billion they spend every year on over-the-counter drugs, either buying products with ingredients lacking evidence of safety or effectiveness, or buying products that are just an expensive brand name version of something the exact identical equivalent of which is available over-the-counter generically.
Somehow it always seems like a better deal if you're getting that extra ingredient, because that's what gives one drug the edge over another. It's got more than the other does.
Well, that's exactly how Madison Avenue plays it. And in fact, what we're talking about is 400 or 500 ingredients. That's all there are that are safe and effective. And yet they've concocted 300,000, quote, different, unquote, products out of just 400 or 500 ingredients. And the way they've done the concocting is to add to one ingredient which is safe and effective, a second one which isn't, call it different, call it super strength, call it extra strength, call it arthritis strength, and make every kind of false and misleading claim they can. Not only is the Food and Drug Administration failing to get these off the market, but we're seeing a horrendous increase in false and misleading advertising and promotion, because the government agency that's supposed to police that, the Federal Trade Commission, has decided that they really don't need to make companies substantiate a lot of their advertising claims as they used to.
Generics are considerably cheaper than brand names. Is that fully accounted for by advertising money?
Much of it is. Example, I would say that the overwhelming majority of the best-selling over-the-counter drugs spend much more on advertising than they do actually manufacturing the drug. A number of products will sell, for instance, $50 million worth of the product and spend 25 or 30 million of that in advertising. In other words, they're plowing most of the money back into advertising. The best way of gauging, you know, there are exceptions, but I think in general, one of the best ways of gauging how well a product is going to do in sales is to find out what its advertising budget is. And in general, the drug industry spends a larger proportion of its sales on advertising than any other industry. And within it, I think that the over-the-counter drugs spend even more than the prescription drugs.
Are there any advertising ploys that you'd recommend against, you know, that you'd warn us against?
Well, we mentioned a couple, the extra strength, maximum strength, the ingredient which doctors recommend most. That was an Anacin commercial. It now is an Anacin 3 commercial talking about acetaminophen instead of aspirin. But most of the companies make some kind of false or misleading statement or the other. Another thing to watch out for is treats X 10 different ways. You don't have 10 different problems usually when you have a cold or any other kind of problem. Over the last several years, one cold preparation after another was trying to increase the number of different symptoms that would treat. One was 7 and then 8 and then 10. I think 10 is what they're up to right now. Well, those are kind of buzzwords to let you know that they're trying to sell you more than you really have. They're trying to create diseases. The phrase Excedrin headache, for example, is just an example of a disease that happens to have the name of a drug in it, as though if there is such a thing, the only way you can treat it is with that kind of product. Certainly the use of authority figures, doctors or at least actors portraying doctors in white coats in the ads, the print ads or the television ads, and voices that are meant to sound like doctors if they aren't doctors in the radio ads are another thing to watch out for.
Okay, if you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Sidney Wolfe, co-founder of the Public Citizens Health Research Group and co-author of the new book, Over-the-Counter Pills That Don't Work, and we'll be opening up the telephones for your questions in a little while. Let's talk specifically about aspirins, and now you have your choice of generics or of all the big-name aspirins, and there's aspirins with different special added ingredients in it. Caffeine has been added to several brands. What are the brands that caffeine is in? And then I'd like you to address if caffeine is a useful thing to have in aspirin.
Well, that's a good example of taking something that is perfectly good, safe, and effective, namely a painkiller, and adding another ingredient. There are only two ingredients in all the over-the-counter painkillers that are safe and effective for pain. One, as you said, is aspirin, and the other has become known as non-aspirin. It's called acetaminophen. Everything else that's in an over-the-counter painkiller lacks evidence of safety or effectiveness, or both, for treating pain, and its presence there certainly jacks up the cost of the drug, to say nothing of giving you an additional ingredient that you can have a bad reaction to, but which you can't really have a benefit from in terms of treating pain. Some of the examples of pain relievers whose only effective and safe ingredient is aspirin, but which something else has been added to, are things like Anacin or Excedrin. Excedrin also has acetaminophen in it. There are other ones where they will take just acetaminophen and add an antihistamine, for instance. And just one doesn't need to know that much about medicine to know that an antihistamine isn't exactly designed for treating pain. And yet, there's a drug called Percogesic, which is heavily promoted to pharmacists so that they will in turn promote it heavily to patients when they ask for a good painkiller, which really is acetaminophen plus the antihistamine thrown in. So the recommendation we would have is don't buy the big variety of heavily advertised aspirin-containing products with something else in them or even just plain brand-name aspirin, and don't buy the great variety of acetaminophen-containing products such as Panadol, Anacin 3, extra-strength Tylenol, St. Joseph's non-aspirin, Percogesic I just mentioned. Instead, buy generic or store brand. A lot of drugstore chains now have their store brand on what is essentially a generic drug. The difference in price, for instance, on the acetaminophen side is two or threefold. The products I mentioned that are simply acetaminophen alone or with an antihistamine cost anywhere from $7 to $10 or $11 for 100 capsules, extra strength, for instance. You can buy exactly the same amount of generic or store brand acetaminophen for about $3. And the same is true on the aspirin side. Store brand or generic aspirin costs anywhere from 79 to 99 cents for 100. Bayer or Bufferin or Anacin cost $2, $3 or more for 100. So it's a waste of money, and if you're getting the extra ingredient, it's also an increased risk without any compensating benefit.
How did caffeine first wind up in aspirin?
One of the amusing, I suppose, answers that the companies give to the question, why do you have caffeine in a painkiller, is that there are a small number of people who become so addicted to or dependent on caffeine from drinking coffee that when they stop, they get a caffeine withdrawal headache. And therefore, if you put a little bit of caffeine in there, it'll treat the caffeine withdrawal headache. Well, it's probably true, but caffeine withdrawal headaches hardly account for most headaches or certainly for most pain. I think what they've done is simply differentiate their product from other products. Anacin, for example, as we mentioned, is simply aspirin and caffeine, but they use phrases like the pain ingredient, which doctors recommend most, and the last thing in the world they are going to talk about is the fact that all it is aspirin and caffeine. We got a letter recently from someone writing to the company that makes it, essentially saying, I was trying this product for a month or two when I went to bed and I couldn't fall asleep. Now I find out that there's caffeine in it. You ought to be ashamed of yourself. So, I mean, there are a lot of surprises when people really start looking on the small print, if they can see it, and finding out what is really in a lot of these products that they buy. The painkillers just happen to be the biggest selling category of over-the-counter drugs. And probably more so than in any category is there a huge amount of money wasted. I would say that in the painkiller category, people are wasting about two-thirds of the money that they spend on these overly priced or combination painkillers when, as we said, the only two ingredients that are effective are aspirin and acetaminophen.
There are also buffered aspirins, which have extra ingredients designed to make the aspirin easier on your stomach so you don't get stomach upset, which many people experience after they take it. What are the ingredients, and are they effective?
The Federal Trade Commission for years has been vamping on the companies that make buffered aspirin products because they have overstated the extent to which the buffering really is effective in terms of preventing ulcers, so that a lot of these ads aren't at least supposed to be running now. We believe that whether you're taking Bufferin or plain generic aspirin or Bayer or Anacin, any of those, the most important thing to do is to have at least a couple glasses of water, preferably a little on the warm side. It'll do two things. One, it will increase the speed with which the pills dissolve, rather than having them sit in your stomach somewhere. And secondly, they'll dilute the pills into a larger volume of water. And that is a way in which you can certainly reduce the acidity, the concentration of the acid that is what aspirin is, in your stomach. And that's something that should be done for any kind of aspirin, and that certainly is as effective or more so than some of these buffered kinds of products. Another sort of unfortunate thing that happens with aspirin is that sometimes it gets included with something that's intended for an entirely different purpose. Alka-Seltzer, for example, is aspirin and baking soda. I mean, it's a slight version on baking soda, but essentially it's baking soda. And we got into a big scrape about 10 years ago with the company making it because it was being promoted, as everyone who's ever heard an Alka-Seltzer ad knows, for the blahs, for I guess I ate too much, and a number of intestinal or stomach problems. And the last thing in the world anyone should do if they really have a stomach problem that might be an early signal of an ulcer is to have aspirin. Occasional use of baking soda, half a teaspoon in a glass of water, is a perfectly good and inexpensive and safe antacid, particularly if you're not on a low-sodium diet and therefore shouldn't be using the baking soda, which is sodium as salt has. But products that have aspirin, which are promoted for antacid purposes, really, it isn't a good idea. In fact, I see that on Alka-Seltzer now, they say that if you've got stomach kinds of symptoms, you should use Alka-Seltzer Gold, which is basically the baking soda without the aspirin thrown in.
Well, before we talk about more over-the-counter drugs, I know the FDA embarked in, I guess, 1972, they started it, a study on the safety and effectiveness of the ingredients in over-the-counter drugs. if they agree, as they do with you, on the ineffectiveness of many of these products, how come they're still being marketed and advertised?
Well, the broader problem goes even beyond the over-the-counter drugs, but as you mentioned before, the prescription drugs. We have been involved in a series of lawsuits to try and stop the FDA from breaking the law. The law goes back even before 1972. 1974, as you mentioned, is when they started the review of the over-the-counter drugs in terms of effectiveness. But the law saying that all drugs have to be effective is now 21 years old. We successfully sued the FDA to speed up the process of getting the prescription drugs that weren't effective off the market. We're now in the U.S. Court of Appeals in Washington to try and accomplish the same thing with the over-the-counter ones. I think the short answer is that the amount of pressure that the drug industry has been able to place on the FDA to slow them down from taking these products off the market or the ingredients off the market in the case of the over-the-counter drugs is really something to be reckoned with. Many of these products sell $20, $30, $40, $50 million a year. And if these companies can buy even a few extra months, let alone 5, 10, 15 years, it is a gold mine for them because they don't invest any research in these products. These products, by and large, the ingredients in them have been around for decades. And it is as close to pure profit as you can imagine, except for the amount that they're forced to put back into advertising so that they can keep misleading people. So the FDA has really yielded to a lot of pressure from the drug industry. And as I said before, the same thing has happened at the FTC, so that the ingredients that shouldn't be on the market are on, and the false misleading promotion for these ingredients and for a lot of other things goes on.
What methods does the drug industry have for pressuring the FDA?
Well, in Washington, the drug industry has literally dozens, if not hundreds, of lawyers working for Washington law firms representing the companies who go in there and threaten the FDA with lawsuits if they do this, throw in every procedural blockade, use or almost abuse the due process that they are granted to just grind things to a slowness, if not to a halt, in terms of getting these ingredients off the market. They will say, oh, we're going to just do another study, remembering that most of these ingredients have been around for 30, 40 years and haven't yet been proven safe and effective. It is not likely that very many of them are suddenly, after all this time, going to come up with studies showing that they are safe and effective. So they're really just buying time, and it's worth paying a lawyer a couple hundred dollars an hour to badger the FDA for a couple weeks to save a couple tens of millions of dollars for the company.
When the FDA completes its study and starts implementing those rules that products that are unsafe or ineffective can't be marketed and advertised, how many of the existing products do you think will be taken off the market?
More than likely, what they'll do is reformulate them. A lot of them that are on the market now have already been reformulated, much to the unawareness of the public that buys them. I think that in general, they get reformulated, but one will hopefully see at the same time a move in the direction of less false and misleading advertising. One of my favorite ads that I hear now is an ad for a product that says, this is exactly the same as product A, but it costs half as much. This ad is accurate. It happens to be for a painkiller, and it reflects the best of real competition. In other words, competition between products on the basis of price instead of competition between products on the basis of contrived differences, which, if they exist at all, are based on the addition of an ineffective ingredient. So I think in the future, one is going to see probably some products will drop out by the wayside because they have so many ingredients in them that aren't effective that they aren't going to be able to survive. But more likely, there will be a reformulation, and you'll have a much tighter war, a good war, a price war that can benefit the consumers, as we are seeing in electronics and other kinds of things today.
I've seen an ad that struck me as very ironic. I think it was for Dristan, and I hope you've seen this ad and can correct me if I'm wrong. But it says that it's now caffeine-free, and I think something else was taken out, maybe an antihistamine. Aspirin.
Dristan used to have caffeine in it, and in fact, this was taken out after the book was finished. We do list the ingredients of all these drugs so that one can see, and we warn that the companies are frequently changing them, so keep looking for the current ingredients on the product. You also can look up any of the ingredients to see whether they're safe and effective. But there's been a big move against caffeine It's a stimulant, obviously. That's why people drink coffee. There is some good work done showing that women who drink a lot of caffeine, or maybe not so much, have an increased risk of having not breast cancer, but just fibrocystic breast disease. So there's been a big move seen with Coca-Cola, Pepsi-Cola, and now Dristan to be caffeine-free. So that is a change that's happened recently in Dristan. Dristan, like a large number of oral cold preparations, has a decongestant in it. And one of the things that we recommend in terms of having a cold, having a blocked nose, and wanting to do something about it is to use a decongestant, but not to use the mega dose that you get in a syrup or a tablet, but rather to use a much smaller dose, about a 50th as much, in the form of nose drops or nose spray. Nose drops or nose spray shouldn't be used for more than 2 or 3 days because they can be irritating. But it certainly doesn't make sense when your nose and sinuses are what's bothering you to dope up your whole body with a decongestant, which translated into English means an upper, because the family of decongestants are in the same family as the diet pills. In fact, Contac contains a drug, phenylpropanolamine, or PPA, which is the same ingredient in virtually all of the over-the-counter diet pills. And it's a dose, as I said, 50 times more than you really need to treat symptoms of a blocked nose.
Would you make that a guideline? Never take something systemic if you can substitute something local?
Absolutely, because what you're doing is doping up your whole body when you really only want to get to one part. Obviously, if you have pain, that is at least usually an internal problem, and it does make sense to take aspirin or acetaminophen, non-aspirin. But for things that relate to a part of the body that you can reach, so to speak, by something like a nose drop or nose spray, it makes much more sense to take a smaller dose of what you need to take where it's needed.
Dr. Sidney Wolfe is my guest. He's the co-founder with Ralph Nader of the Citizens Research, the health research group located in Washington, D.C., and they have just written a new book called Over-the-Counter Pills That Don't Work. It's just been published by Pantheon. We'd like to invite your phone calls now with any questions or comments about over-the-counter drugs. Here's the guidelines. We're asking you to not mention any specific brand names. You can mention ingredients and
categories of products.
Yeah. Our number is 923-2774. Our area code is 215. The number again, 923-2774, and our phones are now open. Let's take a look at laxatives. They're very heavily advertised on TV. You'd think that everybody in the country had constant constipation problems that ruined their mood and their work habits and their family life. Are there instances where you recommend commercial laxatives? Do you recommend avoiding them altogether? And if you recommend them in instances, what ingredients should you stay away from?
The group that's most victimized by laxatives are older people. One reason is that older people were brought up in an era where regularity and one bowel movement a day and so forth were thought to be akin to God almost. One of the first misconceptions that we think people need to get over, which will also help them get over the thought that they need laxatives, is the idea that there is a magic number or time of day or whatever. The magic number particularly is misleading because there are a number of perfectly normal people who have somehow managed to reach the age of 60, 70, 80 only having 4-5 bowel movements a week instead of 7, and voila, they are in perfectly good health. So that we would agree with a government agency, the National Institute of Aging, which has said pretty much that older people shouldn't use laxatives at all. We recommend increasing the amount of liquid in your diet and increasing the amount of fiber by eating fruits and vegetables, or if you don't have as much access to fresh fruits and vegetables, having a vegetable fiber. Again, that's available generically in drugstores. It is available in a much more expensive form in brand name products such as Metamucil, but it's a vegetable fiber brand, for instance, Kellogg's All Brand or generic All Brand or any kind of All Brand is, again, a good source of fiber. A lot of the laxative preparations that are sold not only are unnecessary, but can worsen one's problem with constipation. So our general advice here is avoid laxative preparations except for the so-called bulk-forming ones, essentially code word for for fiber.
Psyllium, which is the ingredient in Metamucil and the other products.
Psyllium is vegetable fiber. That's
Can that become habit-forming in the same way that other laxatives can?
No, it cannot become habit-forming any more than eating a good diet with fiber in it can become habit-forming. That can become habit-forming if you like to eat a good diet with vegetables and fruits. I mean, that's a good habit, though. But in terms of an addictive and physiologic disruption of your gut, it is not habit-forming.
Okay, let's take our first phone call, and my guest again, Dr. Sidney Wolfe, co-founder of the Public Citizens Health Research Group, co-author of the book Over-the-Counter Pills That Don't Work. Our number for your questions is 923-2774. Again, we're asking you to not mention specific brand names. You can mention categories of products or ingredients as well, if you'd like to. Hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Yes, I'd like to ask Dr. Wolfe about his recommendation of nasal sprays. I know that I had used a nasal spray for a two-month period for treatment of allergy problems, and I became very hooked on the nasal spray. It took me 2 months to get off of it.
Well, the recommendation I just made was that you shouldn't be using nasal sprays for more than 2 or 3 days, because even though it is 1/50th the dose, it is applied locally, and it can become irritating, and you can become, quote, addicted to them. Any situation where there's a need for a long-term use of a decongestant, you have to really start wondering what it is that you have. I mean, the most common use, of course, for nasal sprays or nose drops is a cold, and you don't need to use them for more than 2 or 3 days because colds are mainly self-limited. If there is something else, one, you might have sinusitis, which might be bacterial in origin, which might need antibiotics if it is diagnosed as such, might have a serious allergy, which should be better treated with an antihistamine rather than with a decongestant. I don't know what you have, but you've described a very common experience, namely that the long-term use, more than 2 or 3 days of nose drops or nose sprays, can get you in trouble. Fortunately, as I said, most people don't need to use them for longer than that.
Are there any nasal sprays that can be used for longer? None.
No. None of them should be used. There are essentially three ingredients, each of which is safe and effective for nasal sprays. One is called phenylephrine, another is called oxymetazoline, and the other is called xylometazoline, and all three of them in varying degrees can cause irritation and problems if you use them for longer than several days.
Thank you very much for your phone call. Hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
There's a product out on the market. It's been out, I think, for a long time, but it recently been advertised very heavily, and what it's supposed to do is help you to stop smoking. Now, if I remember correctly, and I've been around a little while, I think that the thing contains nicotine. And what I would like to know is what happens when, according to them, the nicotine, the pill or whatever it is dropped, and they don't supply any data. I'd like to hear your remarks on that.
Well, there is one smoking preparation that we talk about in the book, which does not contain nicotine. I believe that at the present time in the United States, there isn't a nicotine-containing smoking deterrent available. There is one in Canada and in some other countries, and right now, I think the Food and Drug Administration is reviewing the evidence on the safety and effectiveness of this. I have seen a study which was published about 10 months ago in the British Medical Journal, which is a British medical publication, which looked like it was very well done, which did show that in combination with some group therapy sessions, in other words, behavior modification, that this kind of it was a chewing gum. It was actually a nicotine-containing chewing gum, that it did work very well. And certainly, given that 320,000 people lose their lives every year from smoking, anything that can facilitate the process of people getting off of cigarettes would be good. But I think that right now there isn't a nicotine-containing, at least chewing gum, available in this country, since at least it's believed by many people that it's the nicotine that prefers the addiction to cigarettes. It would make sense that slowly weaning people off of nicotine might be a good way of taking care of smoking.
Thank you very much for your phone call. Hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Hi, I'm a pediatrician, and I couldn't agree more with what your guest has said. In general, there's one other comment, though, that he didn't make, perhaps he makes in the book, but that I think should be made, which is that
when you have these combination products in a household with small children in the house, the dangers from accidental overdosage are much, much greater.
They're multiplied, essentially, is what you're saying.
Absolutely. I mean, it's just much more difficult to treat a kid who comes in with an unknown ingestion when you know that the products that are in the house, which usually are half a dozen of them at least, and each one has, you know, four or five different drugs in it.
You're absolutely right, and that's really why, as we mentioned briefly at the beginning, I don't know if you were listening, that we recommend buying just single ingredient, usually generically available products.
Right,
A lot of the products that we discuss have huge amounts of alcohol in them. Some of them are 50 proof, 55 proof. And if you add that, particularly when a kid is taking it on top of other kinds of drugs in them, some of these cold preparations are 50 proof plus have four other ingredients. You're absolutely right. It's like, you know, it's like letting a kid loose in a toxicology laboratory and not knowing that what the labels are in the bottle. So
right.
I think that's a very good point.
All right. Okay. Thank you.
Thanks for your call. Bye-bye. If you have any questions, our number is 923-2774. My guest is Sidney Wolfe, co-founder with Ralph Nader of the Public Citizens Health Research Group in Washington, D.C., and co-author of the new book, Over-the-Counter Pills That Don't Work. 923-2774 is the phone number at area code 215. Hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Yes, good afternoon. I'd like to ask the doctor's opinion of people like Dirk Pearson and Sandy Shaw, who seem to advocate taking a lot of different kinds of medications and to stimulate intelligence and that sort of thing. Just wondering how he feels about these sort of people.
Well, I mean, I don't think one can make a generalization about everybody. I have read the book that they wrote, Life Extension, and I find it objectionable, to say the least, to have a picture of someone dressed up, flexing his muscles, and essentially saying, use growth hormone instead of exercising, one of the kinds of advice in the book. The book is a compendium of recommendations to take often very large quantities of a variety of chemicals and drugs in order to extend your life. I would recommend to people to look at the pictures of the people in the book, one of them in particular, find out how old they are, and ask the question whether you think they've really extended their lives.
I was just wondering, do you think there's any danger to this? Because he comes on Merv Griffin show and that sort of thing, and starts talking about, this is a definite fact, and that's a definite fact. And I was wondering, do you have any idea what kind of scientific research he uses?
Well, there is some scientific research, obviously, upon which a number of the things in the book are based. I would say, though, that there are a number of other things in the book, the evidence for which is not in the least bit clear.
Thank you for your call. Hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Yeah, my question has to do with antacid products, which contain magnesium hydroxide and aluminum hydroxide.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they brought in a chemical called simethicone.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what does this simethicone do, or is it necessary?
Well, we don't think it's necessary, and one of the things that we do, we talked a little bit before about short-term use of antacids for occasional indigestion, uses half a teaspoon of baking soda and a glass of water. We're now talking about chronic use of antacids, people that have ulcers, people that have other problems that really require them to chronically use antacids. And we have a chart in which we look at what is in the antacids, how much antacid power they have, and how much they cost. And as you've just mentioned, simethicone has crept into a lot of these products as an extra ingredient. And we really don't think that it is very effective. I mean, we disagree somewhat with the FDA on this, but...
Yeah, well, I find that the magnesium and aluminum products are much better than the... baking soda products for me.
Well, I mean, if you're using an antacid on a chronic basis, the magnesium and aluminum products are exactly what we recommend. We recommend a combination of aluminum and magnesium without, if you want to get it that way, and it's less expensive, without the simethicone. Let me just read you a couple sentences about simethicone is approved as safe and effective to, quote, alleviate or relieve the symptoms of gas. Medical evidence available since this original 1974 decision, however, shown that there is no relationship between any particular symptoms and the amount of gas in the digestive system. An FDA advisory panel, which met after this evidence became available, stated that simethicone lacks evidence of effectiveness in treating abdominal discomfort associated with complaints of gas. So one of the main reasons that simethicone is put in is for, quote, problems of gas. You are talking, on the other hand, about just the antacid properties, and you have hit upon what we agree is the most effective way of treating excess acid, so to speak, namely the combination of magnesium and aluminum.
Okay, thank you for your phone call. Hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Hello, I had a question about the cortisone nasal sprays that are prescribed for allergists. By allergists, it was prescribed for me, which I use instead of the decongestant.
Those are prescription products.
Prescription, yes.
Right.
And, I see. You're dealing only with over-the-counter?
Yeah. This book is limited just to over-the-counter pills.
Can I ask you about this one product?
Well, I mean, I don't know.
I just want to know the safety of using these small doses of inhaled cortisone.
Yeah. Well, without getting into one product, because I think that the same statements can be made of all of those. Those are effective and they are safe. These are drugs that have come on the market recently,
right,
after the time when the laws requiring safety and efficacy were passed.
Mm-hmm.
The problem with many of the ingredients in the over-the-counter pills, on the other hand, is that they came on the market before there was a law requiring proof of effectiveness. So
mm-hmm.
the companies didn't have to submit any evidence, and unfortunately, in many cases, they still haven't submitted evidence that they work. That's not the case with the drugs you're talking about.
Thank you for your phone call. Our number is 923-2774 if you have any questions, and we'd like you to limit your questions to questions about over-the-counter drugs. My guest, Dr. Sidney Wolfe, has co-authored a new book called Over-the-Counter Pills That Don't Work. Since you mentioned cortisone as an ingredient, there's a lot of over-the-counter hydrocortisone ointments now for burns, skin problems, vaginal infections. What do you think of the new hydrocortisone over-the-counter products?
Yeah, just one slight It's not cortisone itself. It's a different kind of, at least somewhat related compound that we're talking about in the other, in the case of the nasal sprays. As far as the over-the-counter preparations for treating poison ivy and so forth, there is less cortisone than in the prescription ones. And some people think that they don't work as well as they remember the prescription one with more cortisone did, and that may be true. We really don't discuss them because it isn't one of the eight leading categories of drugs in the book. But I think that there probably is some evidence that for certain kinds of skin problems, such as the poison ivy, et cetera, that a cortisone cream might be effective. But as I mentioned, for some people, they may need a larger concentration than is available over the counter.
Okay, thank you. That was me. That wasn't a phone call.
Thank you for the question.
That's right. Hey, you're welcome. Hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air. Hi, you're on the air.
Oh, thank you. I'd like to know whether there is one antihistamine, only one. Is antihistamine a generic name or is it a whole drug? And whether it's safe for a child to have antihistamine daily for allergy control.
How old is the child, first of all?
8.
In the discussion of antihistamines, we recommend a couple things. First, antihistamines are very effective, obviously, for treating allergies. We're right now in the middle of the hay fever season. We believe that they should be used alone, not with an additional ingredient, which is often a decongestant. One of the most commonly used products for treating allergies is called chlorotrimetan. And the second concept we want to get across is that you can buy a very safe and effective generic antihistamine, exactly the same ingredient that's in chlorotrimetan. It's called chlorpheniramine maleate. The adult dose is 4 milligrams. Children don't need anywhere near that much. A pill can be broken in half. But what we would recommend for allergies really is to buy, again, a single ingredient product. And in most cases, particularly in the last couple of years, one can buy these things over the counter in a generic form.
Thank you for your call. Hi, this is Fresh Air. You're on the air.
Hello. Doctor, your book sounds really fascinating, but I'd like you to transcend the thesis of the book for a second and address this issue. On one hand, there's a lot of anti-drug literature and an anti-drug mentality that pervades our society. On the other hand, there seems to be a mentality that goes with the advertising that the over-the-counter drug companies do that encourages drug taking for everything from not being able to sleep to going to sleep. And I'd like you to talk about what's being done to control that and educate people about that problem.
Well, I don't think we'll have to transcend beyond what's in the book to do that, because much of the discussion in the book is really directed towards non-drug approaches for a lot of problems. There's as much discussion of that as there is directing people to try safe and effective single-ingredient over-the-counter preparations for their symptoms. So, I mean, I agree fully with you, and particularly for things such as difficulty falling asleep, for constipation, as we mentioned a few minutes ago, for some of the symptoms of a cold, such as a runny nose and a productive cough in which you're bringing things up. For all four of those and a lot of other problems, we don't think that you should run for any drug, even a safe and effective one.
Thank you for your phone call. Before we take the next call, I have another question I'd like to ask you.
Well, thank you for your question.
That's right. There's a lot of herbal and nutritional and holistic remedies now, where a lot of claims are being made for herbal teas and for vitamins and certain foods. Do you think that that the public needs to use as much caution in using that as a remedy as they do in say, over-the-counter drugs?
Let's look at three different groups of chemicals. One is called drugs. Everyone knows about those and knows that those are that they're chemicals sold by big companies that make a lot of money. Another category of chemicals are called vitamins, sold interestingly originally by the same companies. Hoffman La Roche, which makes Valium and Librium, controls much of the world's raw supply of vitamins also. And the third is called herbs. Now, all of these are chemicals. People talk about natural, not natural, but basically there are chemicals in all of them that are active. Now, to be sure, there are some safe and effective drugs. Unfortunately, in the over-the-counter ones, a large proportion of the products have one or more ingredients which aren't safe or effective. In terms of vitamins, again, to be sure, people do need to have a certain amount of a variety of vitamins in order to be healthy. There are people whose diet is deficient enough that we would recommend taking a multiple vitamin. We don't believe that the evidence is very good that huge doses of any of the vitamins in otherwise normal people do anything more than the recommended dose. In other words, mega doses of vitamins are a form of pills that don't work. And I think the same can be true of herbs. Needless to say, historically, herbs or herb equivalent products were the source of a number of medicines that we now use today. But I think that just as there's been an overreaction in the vitamin area and, of course, in the drug area, the same has happened in the herb area. There's an herb for every ill just as there's a pill for every ill, and I don't think that it's any safer or more effective. In some cases, it may be more dangerous. Ginseng, for instance, in large amounts can cause high blood pressure. Several days ago, I was on a television talk show program, and just before I had gone on a live program, they had taped a session with someone who was promoting herbal medicines. And the co-host had taken a big slug of one or two of these herbs in the form of a tea just minutes before our program started. And as our program started, he broke out into a profound sweat, which would be nice if it were hot outside and you were running, but it was cool in that studio and he was not running, and he really felt very uncomfortable and for the first part of this live television program wasn't able to participate in the interview. Now, that's not to say that there's nothing good about any herbs, because I think there are, but I think that we need to apply the same standard to vitamins, herbs, as we would like to apply to pills. If they're safe and effective, fine. I don't care whether they're called a pill, a drug, or an herb, or a vitamin. But if they aren't, we shouldn't be prejudiced in favor of herbs and vitamins because they're natural, even though the evidence is lacking that they're safe and effective. We've gotten in a lot of scrapes with various people over the issue of megadose vitamins. We say, where's the evidence that huge doses of this or that work? If there's good evidence, fine. But if there isn't, why are we pretending that it's okay to do this, but it isn't okay to take drugs?
We have the FDA and books like yours to judge over-the-counter drugs and prescription drugs like your previous book. Where can you go to evaluate the effectiveness of herbal remedies?
Or vitamins. And the problem is that a lot of vitamin enthusiasts were successful in the 70s at getting Congress to pass laws stopping the FDA from being able to require proof of safety and effectiveness for vitamins. And from that time forth, they became known as food supplements and did not have to meet the same standards as they used to have to meet for drugs. And the same, needless to say, is true for herbs. They're looked upon as foods, even though implicitly, if not explicitly, they are making very, very disease-specific claims.
So do you recommend a place to go to evaluate the effectiveness of herbs or vitamins?
Well, unfortunately, there really isn't very much information on it at all, responsible information.
Okay, well, let's take another phone call. 923-2774 is our number. My guest, Dr. Sidney Wolfe, who is the co-founder with Ralph Nader of the Public Citizens Health Research Group in Washington, D.C., and he's co-authored a new book called Over-the-Counter Pills That Don't Work, which evaluates the effectiveness and safety of brand names as well as the ingredients within the brand names of over-the-counter pills. Hi, this is Fresh Air. You're on the air.
Good afternoon. I have a periodontal problem and using a paste of baking soda and peroxide. Since I'm on a sodium-restricted diet and don't know how much of the baking soda is absorbed through my gums, I wonder if there is a substitute product for the baking soda.
I don't think that you need to worry as long as you spit it out. I mean, obviously, you don't need to swallow it at all. You might unintentionally swallow a small fraction of it. I don't think that is really a worry.
Oh, good.
Okay. Well, thank you for your call.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. Are there any ingredients in toothpaste that you're concerned about? I don't know if you'd put them in the category of over-the-counter drug or not.
Well, they are, and there was one which really tells you how ridiculous some of the shenanigans that these companies pull are. We petitioned and eventually sued successfully the FDA a few years ago because the toothpaste manufacturers were putting chloroform, which is a known carcinogen, in toothpaste in order to tingle the tongue, sort of make you feel that there was something uppy or zippy about it. So that was at least one thing that was in toothpaste that we didn't think was a good idea.
Other than that, you think they're all right?
Well, they have artificial dyes and so forth. I mean, we would recommend using a toothpaste that doesn't have any artificial colors, and the artificial colors really obviously don't taste at all, and they're an unnecessary chemical to put in your mouth.
Okay, let's take another call. Hi, this is Fresh Air. You're on the air. Hi, I'm sorry. You're on the air now.
Oh, that's okay. I was wondering about the effectiveness and safety of cough drops as opposed to over-the-counter cough medicine.
Well, it depends what you're using the cough drops for. If you're using them really to stop a cough, they're only effective if they have dextromethorphan in them, which is the one ingredient that we think is a good idea for a cough. A lot of them, in addition to having dextromethorphan or instead of having dextromethorphan, will have a variety of other kinds of menthol and eucalyptus oil and things like that, which really aren't effective in terms of suppressing a cough. One of the reasons people cough is because their throat is dry, and sucking on hard candy, hopefully without food dyes in it, and hopefully not too much of it because it does have sweetness, sugar in it, can be as effective as taking a cough drop.
Okay, thank you for your call.
Thank you.
Hi, this is Fresh Air. You're on the air.
Yes. You were talking about the nicotine in the gum form,
mm-hmm.
and I've been part of that study for a while now. And
how have you been doing? Or do you know whether
I'm a non-smoker now.
What?
I'm a non-smoker now.
Well, that's very good. Was this a double-blind randomized study where you didn't know whether you were getting a sugar pill or nicotine or what?
No, it was a definite study using the product. And
okay.
It was done with behavior modification.
How long had you been smoking before that?
Oh, 20 years.
And
I was up to between 4 and 5 packs a day.
And when you started the program, how many packs were you
smoking? That was it, between 4 and 5.
And how long ago was that? When did you start the program?
May 23rd is when I started.
And are you still chewing the gum?
Not as much, but I find that the gum will...
It's a nice crutch to fall
yes,
back on.
Well, I thought that, you know, it would be a problem that I would be dependent on the gum.
Mm-hmm.
But I found that I was not dependent on the gum because the gum doesn't taste too good.
It tastes like cigarettes.
It tastes like if you swallowed, a chew of tobacco or a pipe juice or something like that. So it's not something you want to do, but it for me, it worked. But
for a lot of other people, it did too. And as I said, when the evidence has been reviewed by the FDA.
Well, I think they're coming out with it. That's why I called to let you know that I think, you know, they're getting ready to market it, but I think that it's going to be through a doctor's prescription. I don't think it's going to be over the counter.
Well, I really don't know about that.
Well, thank you very much for your call. Hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Yes, my question has to do with aluminum as it exists in antacid and its relationship to Alzheimer's disease.
Mm. At the present time, I don't think there is good evidence, acceptable good evidence, that the aluminum in antacids contributes to Alzheimer's disease.
Uh-huh.
There are findings of aluminum accumulations and under certain circumstances in the brains of people with Alzheimer's disease, but that is thought by many people to be the result of Alzheimer's disease rather than the cause of Alzheimer's disease.
I see.
That's still being looked at very carefully, but I don't think at the present time there's any evidence for it.
Thank you very much for your call. Hi, this is Fresh Air. You're on the air.
Hi, Terry. I think you're terrific, and your program's great, and I wonder if the doctor would be willing to make a general comment about diet pills, over-the-counter diet pills.
Don't use them. That would be the general comment,
okay.
Because the ingredient in almost all of them is PPA, or phenylpropanolamine, which can cause high blood pressure, which increases the pulse rate, and which is in many ways just like taking over-the-counter speed. We recommend a modest change in lifestyle, such as walking an extra mile a day and eating 400 fewer calories a day, a total of 500 calories fewer per day, or 3,500 a week, or roughly a pound a week. People have to be more patient with things like losing weight that they have spent 10 or 20, 30 years accumulating. It shouldn't take 10 or 20 or 30 years to lose it, but it may well take 10 or 20 or 30 weeks. The magic cures, whether they be over-the-counter diet pills, prescription diet pills, or the endless succession of never permanently useful diet books, they're magic, and you don't use magic on something that has been with you for a while, so to speak.
Thank you very much for your call. If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Dr. Sidney Wolfe, who co-founded with Ralph Nader the Public Citizens Health Research Group, and he's co-author of the new book, Over-the-Counter Pills That Don't Work. What would you keep stocked in your medicine cabinet? What kinds of over-the-counter remedies, if any, would you keep around?
Well, let's modify the question and say, which ones do I keep around? We think that you can stock your home medicine cabinet with 8 or 9, 10 maybe, depending on whether there's someone around with an allergy, single-ingredient over-the-counter drugs available generically in every case. One would be painkillers, and the two we would recommend, as we mentioned a little bit before, would be aspirin and acetaminophen. A third product to have would be a nose drop or a nose spray. A fourth would be a cough syrup containing dextromethorphan, or DM as it's called for short. There aren't as many products that just have DM in them as we would like. Some have alcohol, some have guaifenesin, which is an ineffective expectorant, but a DM product, that's four. Another product that we would recommend having would be psyllium, unless, as is the case with more people than not, you eat a good diet. Psyllium would be just the generically available vegetable fiber. Another one, as we mentioned, if you have allergies, would be a generic antihistamine such as chlorpheniramine maleate, 4-milligram tablets, which cost about a third as much as the various brand name products containing antihistamines. Petroleum jelly as a protectant. A lot of the hemorrhoid preparations have a protectant in them, such as Vaseline or generically petroleum jelly, and a lot of other things in them which lack evidence of effectiveness. It's the protectant that is very likely doing the job there, not these ineffective ingredients. Baking soda. Useful to brush your teeth every once in a while with it because it does decrease the amount of acid around your tooth gum line and can be helpful in terms of making it less friendly for bacteria to grow there, but also, as we mentioned before, as an occasional stress, occasional antacid for upset stomach. That's an example of the kinds of products that we stock in our home pharmacy and that can be bought for a total of $10 or $15 for at least a year's worth instead of spending, as many people do, $50, $100 for a family for a year of overpriced and often containing ineffective ingredient products.
I've seen countless commercials where a consumer walks into the pharmacy and asks the pharmacist for their recommendation, and the wise pharmacist suggests the brand name being advertised. I don't think I've ever actually asked a pharmacist for a recommendation on an over-the-counter remedy. Do you offhand think it's a good idea?
Well, we think that the way in which pharmacists are victimized by drug advertising is up there with the way consumers are victimized in the television ads, or doctors are victimized, so to speak, in the medical journal ads. And what it has to do with is ads in pharmacist journals where the company is convincing the pharmacist to recommend, in the circumstance that you just went over, Terry, this product because it's the most profitable. And we discuss in the book examples of ads in pharmacy journals where it says number one for profits. And every year, one of the pharmacy journals has an issue where they list in order the products most recommended by pharmacists in various categories. And it's interesting that in that same issue, all of the winning products, with maybe one exception, has a full-page ad saying we're number one for profits and things like that. They don't even discuss what's in the drug at all. It's just that it's the most profitable. And certainly that's something that can convince the pharmacist to recommend this one instead of that one, even though it may not be any better and might be worse than something that is less expensive and more effective.
Well, it's been very informative to hear what you have to say. I regret that we're out of time. I want to thank you a lot for being with us on Fresh Air today.
Nice. Thanks. Finally being on your program.
Dr. Sidney Wolf has been my guest, and his group is based in Washington, D.C. It's called the Public Citizens Health Research Group, and that was co-founded by Dr. Wolf and Ralph Nader in 1971. They do research into the effectiveness and health and safety of drugs, both over-the-counter and prescription foods, and the safety of the workplace. The new book that's co-authored by Sidney Wolf and other members of the Health Research Group is titled Over-the-Counter Pills That Don't Work. It's published in paperback by Pantheon. The title again, Over-the-Counter Pills That Don't Work. And again, thank you for being with us.